It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Buses, cars, bikes, pedestrians, they're all looking for ways to safely get around the city's downtown streets. The Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership is heading up a year-long study on how downtown streets could and should be used. Chris Watts is the Vice President of Mobility for the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. Chris, welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
You're partnering with the City, Port Authority, Southwestern Pennsylvania Commission on the study. Why is it needed?
It's a great question. As we've been seeing in downtown, really the city of Pittsburgh, this is a time of significant growth. Downtown over the last 10 years has experienced over $5 billion of investment with over $3.5 billion in the pipeline. And we want to make sure that what happens on the streets and what happens to the people in the city is intentional. That's why we want to go through a process that includes a lot of outreach, a lot of inputs, but to determine where we want, as a community, downtown streets and sidewalks to look into the future.
Significant growth, but do you expect more congestion downtown with that growth?
That's a great question, and that's really why we want to do this plan. You know, as we know, there's about 110,000 daily commuters into our tightly packed, landlocked Golden Triangle, and without thinking through how people get around in and to downtown Pittsburgh, there is going to be more congestion. Single occupancy vehicles are a challenge with navigating through our tight quarters and tight streets. And that's why this study is designed to explore different options. How can we make mass transit a better experience for all? How can we encourage people to walk and bike into downtown Pittsburgh in ways that are intuitive and comfortable? So this study is going to look at all different modes of transportation, but really understanding that, you know, any growth that we project into the future is grounded and informed by strategies that the public and our stakeholders in downtown want to see.
Why might there be more congestion? Our population certainly isn't increasing.
Absolutely. Our population is increasing, but as we're seeing in downtown and even greater downtown Pittsburgh, there is significant growth in areas that haven't seen growth in the past. We're seeing a lot of new development in the Strip District. We're seeing a lot of new development in the new 28-acre site that's coming with the Pittsburgh Penguins are developing. We're seeing the North Shore with new restaurants and potential residential. And the intention behind this study is to plan for that future growth and to make sure that we can optimize what we currently have. You know, our current system of streets was designed a long time ago and doesn't necessarily meet its potential in terms of providing an experience for all modes of transportation that is most efficient. So a big part of the study isn't just planning for future growth, but it really is looking to optimize what we have now in a plan that can be implemented. We want a plan that doesn't just sit on the shelf. We want a plan that folks are comfortable with a level of change, but is really about optimizing the streets and to allow for better traffic flow for all modes.
One of your partners, the Port Authority Board, is scheduled to vote Friday on approving moving forward with this study. So what exactly will you have studied?
That's a great question. The first thing we want to study is just understanding the existing conditions, just really getting informed of how people are getting to downtown. There's a lot of different modes. There was a recent study that came out this past spring called Make My Trip Count that informed how people are getting downtown, which is a big basis for where we want to see people go into the future. So the study is going to first understand how people get around downtown, but also understand what they want to see in a downtown mobility network. We're also going to explore what we think future conditions will look like by taking in a lot of inputs from businesses, employers, property owners, and developers, and doing some projections of where we understand future growth to come from and where we see that happening. And those inputs are helping to inform, you know, what that mobility network looks like. You know, we think of just streets as places for cars to go, but it's really a network. How the streets connect to the sidewalks, how do they connect to the ways people get in downtown? The whole purpose of the study is to take the inputs of the data, take the inputs of what the people want, and use that to determine a street and sidewalk network that allows for better traffic flow, particularly during the times of most congestion. You know, AM, PM peak periods, as well as special events. We want to see which streets should be prioritized for cars, which streets could be better used for buses, and where those bike lanes would be most appropriate.
Could there be almost like an HOV lane, HOV street, for personal vehicles, but having more than one person in those vehicles?
I think all options are on the table. I mean, we know that mass transit moves the most people into downtown Pittsburgh, the Port Authority system particularly. About 40% of folks coming into downtown Pittsburgh every day take public transit, and we have very limited priority infrastructure and signals for mass transit. And so things like that are certainly on the table to explore how our streets can be optimized for the modes that move the most people.
Right. Will you look at accessibility, ADA compliance for downtown streets?
That's a fantastic question, and I think a huge priority for this study. We don't just see the streets as the sole component of the downtown mobility network. The sidewalks are another huge piece of what really move the most people. You know, everyone's a pedestrian when they come downtown, and right now, you know, sidewalk quality is you know, not where we'd like it to be in all areas of downtown, and folks that not just walk, but folks that roll or need other accessible accommodations are certainly people that need great accommodations and also deserve a great experience downtown. And so things like understanding what quarters should be for pedestrians or what quarters are best for accessible drop-off and pickup are a part of the study as well.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're speaking with Chris Watts. He's the Vice President for Mobility at the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. When you look at transportation technology, is there an environmental component to this, whether it's reducing the number of motorized vehicles that are emitting pollutants?
An environmental concern is definitely on the table. You know, as we've seen over the past few years, the city has come out with a few various plans that talk about reducing emissions throughout the city. One of the largest emitters of carbon dioxide emissions is transportation network. So looking at how changing modes to more efficient modes, whether it's, you know, from single occupancy vehicles to carpooling, ride sharing, to public transit, to walking, biking, is absolutely a part of this. A component of the plan will actually set specific goals on and targets of where we see future mode share, how people are getting around to the future, which will absolutely have a underlying emissions reduction goal as well. You know, air quality in downtown has its challenges sometimes, particularly of where we're set along the rivers at the confluence. And that's where we want to make sure that, you know, when we're not just thinking about environment, you know, as it relates to transportation, but also as it relates to people's experience and air quality downtown as well. So more sustainable modes mean a better experience for those downtown.
You have a complicated network of development projects on these downtown streets, the planned bus rapid transit, self-driving car testing, bike lanes, all on relatively narrow streets. You said compact golden triangle. So what can you really do in that compact area to improve mobility?
That's a great question. You can look at any of the streets in downtown. And right now, a majority of the streets are being used by all modes of transportation at all times. Certainly, some curbs have different regulations at various moments. But this study is to examine what streets should be prioritized for different modes, whether it's through infrastructure or enforcement or various policies, and then inform the public and also make sure that different interventions and projects that come down into the future are then looking at this downtown and the greater downtown as a network. You know, sometimes projects don't take the whole big picture into consideration, and that may lead to future problems. But a big purpose of this study is to establish a set of guiding principles as well as a map and plan that can then be used to inform future projects that aren't, you know, conflicting with each other.
You're collaborating with the Port Authority, the city's Department of Mobility, the Southwestern Pennsylvania Commission. You all have different goals, different missions. How do you develop a mobility plan that works for all and you maybe don't shortchange any of your partners?
That's a great question. I mean, the public agencies that you just mentioned, I think we're at a really good time where our leadership is aligned with our goals. And we all value collaboration, and we all value a shared process. You know, we at the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership don't see us as, you know, we don't see this as our plan. We see this as the region's plan. And the public sector agencies that we're working with are stewards of that downtown, as well as us with our stakeholders at the PDP, with is the business community, major employers, property owners, residents, and you know all the folks that enjoy and visit downtown. And so we see this collaboration between stakeholders not just as something that needs to happen in order to get things done, but something that's essential to make a plan that can actually be implemented, because there's a lot of competing interests.
Stakeholders who aren't part of the organization, so how are you going to get public input that people actually use these streets, use these sidewalks?
That's a great question. And one of the most intentional components of developing what we wanted to see in this plan is how do we get the public's feedback? We understand that downtown is not just for the employees. Downtown is not just for, you know, the folks in the government sector. Downtown is for all. You know, that means folks that are connecting through downtown to get the jobs, to get the healthcare, to get the education. And we're fortunate to have good relationships with organizations that represent those individuals that we will want to bring to the table through this process. But we'll also have public meetings, online surveys, other ways to meet people where they are at the various events that happen throughout the region. So look forward to that this fall.
Less than 2 minutes left. Timeline for the plan?
Great question. We're hoping to select a consultant within the next month, and that consultant team is going to work with us on scheduling what this looks like over the next year. Mm-hmm. We hope that this phase of the plan, developing some guiding principles, goals, and the network map, is just the first step in a long-term process to determine the goals and priorities of downtown into the future.
Is there a budget to implement a plan when it is developed, and who's on the hook for paying it?
That's a great question too. That's the power of partnership right now. As you mentioned, the Port Authority, Department of Mobility Infrastructure, and SPC are all part of this plan, not just for their insights, but also for informed future investments. And so it's our intention that this plan is going to identify specific projects and capital budget allocations that can be utilized by these public sector partners into the future.
In just a few sentences, will the plan be flexible, maybe to anticipate changes in mobility a decade or so from now?
It has to be flexible. I think the nature of a plan that we intend to be implemented, it's going to require trade-offs and compromise. And the first step of the plan is establishing guiding principles that we as a region want to see for downtown. And those guiding principles can be applied for any future project, for any future policy. So the network plan that we come out with today is going to set the stage for long-term change into the future.
Chris Watts is the Vice President of Mobility for the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. Chris, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. Kids and adults on the autism spectrum have a new place to relax at the Pittsburgh International Airport. Then, a fungus rampaging cicada populations in our region is transforming the bugs into violent mutants, not unlike the zombies Pittsburghers know so well. And a new federal policy could take 3 million people across 43 states off of the SNAP registry. How will this affect people in Pennsylvania? Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
The Beastie Boys scored the first number one rap album in America with their debut, Licensed to Ill, in 1986, but expectations were mixed when it came time for the follow-up. Some people were convinced the Beasties were just a one-hit novelty act thanks to the success of You Gotta Fight for Your Right to Party, a song that was a mainstay on MTV. Response was initially cool, but the album went on to sell over 2 million copies. Paul's Boutique was released 30 years ago today, and you can learn more about this iconic album tonight from 8 to 9 on WYEP. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
After 6 years as director of the Allegheny County Health Department, Dr. Karen Hacker is leaving for a job at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. During her high-profile tenure, Dr. Hacker took on the opioid crisis and the enforcement of air pollution permits for industrial plants, including Clairton Coke Works, the largest coke-making facility in North America. Oliver Morrison, an environment reporter for Public Source, interviewed Karen Hacker for a piece about her time on the job. Morrison says Hacker asked about the possibility of shutting down the Clairton plant. She was quickly told by staff that would be outside the legal authority of her department.
She was told early on that she had to be careful about how she used her resources because there was a lot of these limitations. And so what she realized early on in her department is that the legal team she had wasn't ready to take on that challenge. She needed to replace them, and they needed to slowly start ratcheting up the pressure. Here's a little bit of what she said about that.
The regulatory world is super challenging. This constant question of what can I do? Are we going to end up in court for the next 20 years because what we did was totally out of our jurisdiction? How does that then serve the population of Allegheny County?
In the article, she's described as a reformer, someone who took over this dysfunctional agency. As you mentioned, the legal department was not up to snuff. What was the department like when she came in?
According to everyone I talked to, it was just really disorganized. They didn't have any heads of departments. They were lacking some really basic information. Like, they didn't know where in the county there were particular diseases or how many, or they couldn't access that data and get it to people. If any of the people listening think about Karen Hacker in a time that they've seen her in public recently, probably one of the things they most remember is her putting on her PowerPoint slide. She has these really detailed maps where she talks about cancer rates and looks at where in the county are these problems occurring, like who is suffering the most. And she's found, you know, some trends such as that low-income African-American population has been suffering, but also that a lot of the health problems have moved down towards the Mon Valley. And because she's been able to organize the department better and access more data, that we know a lot more about the health issues in the county.
So what kinds of progress has she been able to make?
One of the things I think she'd point to is decreased lead levels in children. So one of the big crises that happened was in 2016. Suddenly, the lead in the Pittsburgh water supply was above the EPA threshold. And one of the things she came in and did is she took all that data that she'd gathered and helped PWSA say, hey, where should we be changing lead lines? Where does it matter the most? And she pointed to even street by street where children were showing the most elevated lead levels. And that's led to a decline in those lead levels.
And that was lead that was coming from lead paint in their homes.
A lot of it was coming from lead paint in their homes, but there was a public outcry about lead in the water because this is following the crisis in Flint. Actually, we have a little clip here where Karen talks about how frustrated she was that people wouldn't listen to her.
You know, when I went out and said that, okay, water, we have a problem with water, but the fact is that our bigger problem is with paint. It was not met with we agree with the doctor. It was met with, no, she doesn't know what she's talking about. And that's frustrating.
What did she have to say about air quality progress?
I think this has probably been the most prominent and controversial part of her legacy. I think what her critics would say is that she moved too slowly. They're happy now because she started ratcheting up pressure. She instituted $1 million fines. There have been more than $2 million in fines against U.S. Steel for the pollution at Clairton Coke Works and surrounding facilities, which is the most that there's ever been. She's doing more than there's ever been done before. Her critics would say that we're still seeing pollution that is some of the highest and worst in the nation.
Oliver Morrison is the environment reporter for Public Source. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This week, Pittsburgh International Airport opened a sensory room for kids and adults on the autism spectrum to decompress from the stress of air travel. 90.5 WESA's Kathleen Davis reports traveling can be very difficult for people with special needs.
At the Pittsburgh International Airport, past security after the indoor train, at the end of Concourse A is a quiet multi-room space with soft places to sit and crawl into and colorful light fixtures. It's a sensory room for people with autism and special needs to relax before a flight. At a press conference Tuesday, airport CEO Christina Casota said this was a big deal for the airport.
We believe that we're making a difference for thousands of people in the region and for those coming to visit.
Traveling through an airport can be stressful for anyone. For people on the autism spectrum, says University of Pittsburgh professor Rachel Robertson, the sensory bombardment can make the experience even more intense.
Between like smells and sounds and sights and noise with announcements, all of that is kind of can be alarming for a lot of typical people, but for people with autism, it could be really terrifying, I think.
Jason Rudge pitched the idea for the sensory room. He's a heavy equipment operator at Pitt, and he has a 4-year-old son named Presley. Presley is on the autism spectrum and is considered nonverbal, though he can say a couple words in a row. I spoke with Rudge inside the sensory room while Presley watched Mickey Mouse on an iPad. Presley's sensory processing issues can make some experiences really hard, so flying commercially wasn't really an option. Rudge says the first sensory room he saw was at Presley's school in Greensburg, which he says made his son more comfortable there.
After that, I mean, I'm sitting at work thinking, you know, wonder if we'll ever be able to go on vacation. So I said, why don't we put a sensory room in the airport?
He wrote a letter to airport CEO Kasotis, and the ball got rolling. This isn't the first sensory room at an airport. There are at least six, most of those in the U.S. But Kasotis says this may be the most comprehensive, in part because it includes a recreated airplane cabin with real airplane seats, trays, windows, and overhead storage.
It's an amazing opportunity for people to get comfortable, for kids to get comfortable. What does it mean to put on a seatbelt? Can we raise and lower the shade, the window shade? What about the tray table? You know, how does it feel to sit in this seat?
Not only was Presley drawn to that room, his mom, Sharon Rudge, says he was even more verbal than usual.
He really thought he was taken off. He would say, you know, ready, set, go. He would say, 3, 2, 1, blast off.
Pitt's Rachel Robertson says airports in general are not very friendly to people with autism, and there's a long way to go to make travel easier for people with special needs.
I don't know whether more families with autism will choose air travel because of Pittsburgh's room in particular, but maybe if it became more of a national trend, that might be something that might make people more open to considering air travel if they have kids with autism.
Jason Rudge says he hopes that if the families of kids with autism learn about the sensory room at Pitt, they'll feel more empowered to travel.
You can't sit at home your whole entire life and not do anything because you have a child with special needs or an adult living with special needs. Now you can go out and travel.
Mom Sharon Rudge says the sensory-friendly room at Pitt has inspired the family to plan a vacation. Kathleen Davis, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburghers are no strangers to zombie fiction, but a fungus affecting cicadas in our region could make this summer the night of the chirping dead. West Virginia University researchers have been studying the effects of this fungus on cicadas. WVU forest pathologist Matt Kasson spoke with The Confluence's Kylie Kaczynski.
The headlines are sensational. Zombie bugs are among us. But this fungus you're studying, Massospora cicadina, is sort of inhibiting these bugs from controlling their own bodies. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So how is this fungus affecting cicadas?
Well, the fungus has a long co-evolved relationship with the cicadas. It's been infecting cicadas for as long as cicadas have been around, and it kind of modifies behaviors in two ways. The first is that it seems to enhance the typical behaviors of cicadas. We see infected cicadas flying around a lot, engaging in mating behaviors a lot. This is typical of healthy individuals. And then there's this kind of hypersexualization where infected individuals, males, for example, in addition to attempting to mate with females, will also pretend to be females to engage with males to further spread the fungus. And this is all behavioral modification on the part of the fungus to ensure that it's spread to as many individuals as possible.
So where does this fungus live and how does it attach itself to the cicadas?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the fungus, for a good part of its life cycle, hangs out underground in the form of these really thick-walled spores. And it's really, they start to interact with the cicadas when they come up in the 17th year as they get ready to emerge and molt into adults. They produce these kind of vertical emergence chambers, subsurface, right below bricks and right below leaves. It's there where they first encounter the spores. And we believe that the spores are actually cueing in to the hormones of the cicadas. That's how they know to germinate. That's how they know that they've found the right host.
Spreading on one host, it sort of replaces that part of the bug, and that part of the bug becomes sort of like a sculpture of the bug, but it's the fungus?
That's right. Yeah, it looks a lot like the abdomen. It's shaped like the abdomen, but it's all fungal tissue. And, you know, the cicadas that are infected, it's like they don't even notice that the whole backside of their body has been replaced by fungal tissue. And that's why they continue to engage in these activities. And we kind of hypothesized that these compounds we found in these fungi could explain why they continue to do this, despite the fact that, you know, a third to half their body has completely fallen off and been replaced by this fungus.
To someone observing, what does it look like? What color is it? What's the texture? How would I know if a cicada had this fungus?
Yeah, it's actually pretty obvious, even to the amateur. The backside looks like chalk coming out of the abdomen. And in fact, if you were to kind of rub it on a chalkboard, it would come off like chalk. It's very granular, very powdery, and it's just this kind of dense white fungal plug on the backside.
So the cicadas can be infected by the fungus when they emerge from the soil, and they also can transmit the fungus sexually. Is there a difference in what the bug experiences depending on how they're infected?
Yeah, we know that the cicadas that emerge infected from the soil develop what we call conidial infections. These are kind of asexual spores that are spread to secondary cicadas. Those are the ones that are containing the highest amounts of these compounds that we described in our paper. And we know that the individuals that acquire the infections through sexual contact develop what's called a resting spore infection. And those spores eventually make their way back into the soil to complete the cycle of the fungus. But we also know that those secondary infections also have lower amounts of these psychoactive compounds. So it appears that the compounds are more important in that early stage infection, where it's driving behavior to make as much contact with secondary individuals as possible.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kylie Kaczynski. We're talking to forest pathologist Matt Kasson at West Virginia University about his research exploring a fungus affecting cicadas. So Matt, WVU researchers, including yourself, have been learning about the chemical makeup of Massospora. How does it work?
What we found is that there were about 1,000 to 1,500 unique compounds that were present only in the fungal plugs. And of those compounds, a few of them stood out because there are known alkaloids, and alkaloids are these interesting metabolites that have known impacts on vertebrates, including psilocybin and cathinone, which were two of the ones that we kind of highlighted in our study. So, you know, I want to emphasize the fact that although we focused on these two psychedelic compounds, there were over 1,000 compounds.
I just want to clarify, those two compounds are the chemicals in hallucinogenic mushrooms, correct?
Well, one of them is. Psilocybin is the active compound in hallucinogenic mushrooms. The other compound, cathinone, is actually an amphetamine that's found native in cat plant, which is found in the Horn of Africa and utilized in the Arabian Peninsula.
So we know how those affect humans. Do we know anything about how they're affecting the cicadas, those two particular chemicals?
This is kind of the complicated part of the project, is that both these compounds are DEA regulated. Fortunately for us, there was a lot of studies done on the impacts of these compounds on invertebrates, including insects, back in the 60s and 70s. We know, for example, that when you give ants amphetamines, they get more aggressive. We know that if you give spiders psilocybin or LSD, they produce really unusual webs. They call them drug webs. So there's a number of studies that kind of we can like lean on and start to understand how these compounds may impact invertebrates.
So the fungus takes over part of their body. How are these cicadas still living? How are they still moving around and flying?
That's really the question we asked when we first started this study. You know, we would find individuals where a third to half their body was missing, and yet they were moving around as if nothing had happened, as if nothing was wrong. And it was that kind of prolonged wakefulness that really drove our research question. We know, for example, that during war, combat soldiers were given amphetamines. And we know that that gave them, you know, kind of increased stamina and things like that. And we're seeing that probably to be true in the cicada system as well. I know, for example, if my leg were chopped off, I might not have the same kind of stamina that if I was completely intact. So you think about this from the cicada standpoint, they're having their abdomens cut open, their genitalia basically cut off, yet they're continuing on with a lot of energy. And, you know, the amphetamine that we're finding present in these fungal plugs could explain a lot of that.
You're studying how this affects annual cicadas and periodical cicadas, those bugs that only emerge every 17 years or so. Have you found a difference in how the fungus affects the two types?
We see kind of similar behaviors in both, but just to clarify, in the periodical cicadas, we're finding the amphetamine compound. In the annual cicadas, we're finding the psilocybin or the magic mushroom compound. But we think that they're acting similarly to modify behavior.
Are there any implications for humans that might come in contact with this fungus? Is there something humans should be doing to prevent it from spreading?
No, not necessarily. I mean, the question we get a lot is, if I eat one of these cicadas, will I trip or, you know, will it cause euphoria or things like that? And, you know, the dose is pretty low. It would take a lot of cicadas to really impact a human. But I think, you know, with regard to, like, the impact on humans is really more of a pharmaceutical impact. You know, if we find novel biosynthetic routes for these compounds, might make it easier to synthesize some of these compounds in the lab, and we might find novel intermediate compounds that could have some utility in medicine or in the pharmaceutical industry. So the finding that these compounds are present really raises the question, what else is out there, and how could we utilize them for human medicine, or how could we utilize them, you know, as a pharmaceutical for different illnesses? Right now, we're still in the discovery phase, but as we uncover more and more compounds potentially and these other behavior-modifying insect pathogens, it might be the next front for, you know, bioprospecting.
Matt Kasson is a forest pathologist and professor at West Virginia University. Matt, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Trump administration tried and failed through the Farm Bill last year to add more limitations to the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as food stamps. But there's a new proposal in the works that could affect up to 3 million people nationwide. What about Pennsylvanians? Ann Sanders is the public policy advocate of the local hunger advocacy group Just Harvest. She spoke yesterday with The Confluence's Megan Harris.
So the basics, how would this new proposal change what happens right now in Pennsylvania?
So, well, first and foremost, it would remove many people from the program. About 9% of recipients of SNAP benefits, also known as food stamps, would lose their benefit automatically under this proposal. It would also restrict eligibility so that fewer people who may be struggling to afford food would be able to participate in the program.
Who exactly are SNAP recipients here in Pittsburgh?
About half of people who receive SNAP are children, generally speaking. This proposed rule targets families that are in higher income brackets, and because of the way that the state does that, there's an even higher threshold for families where someone is 60 or older or has a disability. So the vast majority of families that are going to be impacted by this are families where someone is 60 or older or has a disability. So at Just Harvest, we do application assistance, and I looked at folks that we've personally served and helped them apply because we had some of their income information. And almost 3 out of 4 families that were eligible under this provision that would lose benefits had someone in the family that was over age 60 or someone who had disability, and the other 25% were working families, and most half of them had children. So you're looking at working families who are doing their best and struggling to get by. And you're looking at people who are receiving Social Security benefits, who have worked and paid into the system and are still struggling to get by. And that's who's going to get impacted by this the most.
It would be revising the rules of so-called broad-based categorical eligibility. What does that mean for the layperson?
The people in the federal government often decide that states should be able to be flexible with how programs are administered. So the federal rule is that a family has to have income below 130% of the poverty guidelines, which for a family of 4 is about $25,000 a year. In Pennsylvania, we've increased that to 160% of the guidelines, which is about $40,000 a year. But even if you're below that income guideline, that doesn't necessarily mean that you would qualify. You still have to meet a separate income test that takes into account your household's expenses. So you'd still have to show that you're not able to afford to buy food because of rent or childcare, things like that.
So if this new proposal were to go into effect, how would that be changed?
So every state would have to have the same income guideline, and that would be that $25,000 limit for a family of four. So if you were over that limit, you wouldn't be eligible regardless of how much you were struggling to pay for housing and other things.
How many people in Pittsburgh do you think that this would affect?
I don't have the local data currently. I know that last year Congress was looking at eliminating this rule and they debated it very heavily.
That was part of the federal farm bill that passed ultimately without this.
Yes, exactly. So they debated it, they thought about it, and they decided to keep it. So that was what lawmakers, people who write the law, decided. And at the time, the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services told me that statewide, about 70,000 households, that's families, will lose benefits, which is, again, about 9% of all recipients. So that's locally, we'd be looking about the same number.
The Trump administration, through the Department of Agriculture, has said that the people who would ultimately be removed don't actually need food stamps, that it's a waste of money. How would you respond to that?
It's really interesting that he said that, because in the proposal, USDA notes that $3 billion less will be spent at grocery stores. So that's $3 billion less food annually every year that will be purchased. So clearly people are using that money to buy food because they need food. Also, like I said, the income guideline for a family of four will now be a little bit over $25,000. And we all know people who are making more than that, making $30,000 a year for a family of four, who can't afford to put food on the table. And so the idea that, you know, everyone who is above that dollar limit isn't in need is, I don't, based on sort of an ignorance of what most Americans are struggling with.
So if this rule goes through, when would it go into effect, and what would that trigger for organizations like Just Harvest?
So right now where we're at, this is a proposal that the Trump administration has put forward to change a regulation. Whenever they do that, there's a 60-day comment period. That 60 days starts today. So the public, anyone in the public, can go and submit a comment about how this rule would affect them, their family, their community. And we'll have resources at Just Harvest's website if people want to know more information about that. And then after that 60-day comment period, the U.S. Department of Agriculture will be required to review all individual comments, make responses to them when they make their final rule. That can take several months. It can take up to a year. And then after that, they would state their final rule. And then after that final rule comes out, it would go into effect after that.
So that's all the bureaucracy. What about here in Pittsburgh? What would it look like for the average recipient of SNAP?
So if this rule were to go forward, it would be very devastating for lots of people in our community. I mean that a lot of people who are relying on SNAP, even just for some of their food budget, maybe only getting $20 or $30 a month in benefits, they would have to figure out how to supplement that. A lot of times people will do that by buying lower quality foods that aren't as healthy, or relying on food pantries or more on friends and family members who may also be financially struggling. So it would be very devastating for our community. Another thing that would happen is that when someone receives SNAP benefits for their family, their kids automatically qualify for school meals. They're directly
the free and reduced lunch program.
Exactly. And in the city of Pittsburgh, because so many of the students in the school district directly certify for that program, we're able to have universally free breakfasts and lunches under the community eligibility provision, is what it's called. So the down effect is that school districts who may be near that 40% threshold will no longer meet that threshold, and they won't be able to participate that and provide everyone free breakfast and lunch.
Have you been in contact with Pittsburgh Public Schools or other districts in the area about a what-if scenario if something like that were to happen?
So because we have, like I said, several months, we haven't gone that far yet. But certainly if it looks like we're getting close to the end, and as this comment period goes on, we'll certainly be reaching out and having those conversations.
Ann Sanders is the public policy advocate of Just Harvest, the local nonprofit that helps fight hunger. Ann, thanks for making time.
Thanks for having me.
That was The Confluence's Megan Harris. And for today, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, raids began last week by Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers targeting 2,000 migrant families nationwide. Immigrant advocate organizations, including Casa San Jose here in Pittsburgh, say those investigations are scare tactics. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovic, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.